The Italian Wine Podcast is the community-driven platform for Italian wine geeks around the world. Support the show by donating at italianwinepodcast.com. Donate 5 or more euros and we'll send you a copy of our latest book, My Italian Grape Geek Journal, absolutely free. To get your free copy of My Italian Grape Geek Journal, click support us at italianwinepodcast.com or wherever you get your pods. Grazie mille.
Welcome to this special Italian Wine Podcast broadcast. This episode is a recording off Clubhouse, the popular drop-in audio chat. This Clubhouse session was taken from the Wine Business Club and Italian Wine Club. Listen in as wine lovers and experts alike engage in some great conversation on a range of topics in wine. If you enjoy listening, please consider donating through italianwinepodcast.com. Any amount helps cover equipment, production, and publication costs. And remember to subscribe and rate our show wherever you tune in.
Welcome to another episode of Clubhouse Ambassadors Corner. So today we have Scott Thomas and he has selected Alessio Cecchini. Did I pronounce it right, Alessio?
Yes.
Okay. And Elisabetta Fagioli. So actually we met Elisabetta before during Slow Wine and we had an interview with her and we had an amazing time having her as our guest during our Slow Wine. So I'm so happy that she's here too. Before we dive in for their discussion, I wanted to introduce to the audience Scott Thomas. So Scott Thomas has an extensive 20-year career in the wine industry with roles as a sommelier in distribution and sales management and education. He is the founder of Grappolo Wine School in Denver, which offers immersive wine travel, wine events, and structured courses, including the Via Italian Wine Maestro certification. He's the wine director at Restaurant Olivia, a mighty pasta focused with an Italian heavy wine list. So I'm actually curious. So this is my only question about your bio, Scott. Of all the Italian wine grapes there are in Italy, why did you choose Grappolo as the name of your wine school?
Well, Grappolo, as I understand it, is the Italian word for bunch. So my logo is a grape bunch, and because everything starts with the grapes, and that was my philosophy behind it, because my history with Italian wines, I felt it was a fitting symbol and a fitting word to represent my philosophy.
That's so sad. That's really amazing. Anyway, so I am going to ask you, why did you select Alessio and Elisabetta as your favorite producer today?
Well, in simple terms, I feel like I'm always trying to search for producers who can kind of help me grasp a particular region or particular grape variety specifically. And Vernaccia, of course, during our studies, being a Via ambassador, they were mentioned multiple times, Montan Italy, especially as a, you know, historic and producing a traditional style. So I am leading a study trip to Tuscany in June with my wife and I, and we decided that we wanted to visit producers who, you know, follow the same philosophy. So we booked a visit at Montan Italy in January, and literally after that tasting, after that meeting with Elisabetta Alessio in Elisabetta's home, I mean, it left a really lasting impression on me. And it's really difficult to kind of capture in words, but it's something you can feel when you're there. And then I think you can certainly feel it in the wines that this place is quite special, because Elisabetta's somewhat created a bastion of history here. Well, you know, a kilometer away, there are millions and millions of tourists that roll through San Gimignano. So this was my real motive, let's say.
Yes, definitely. And then how did you discover the wines of Montan Italy Winery?
I think at first was at a wine bar right down the street. I believe they were pouring Il Templar, which is their Vernaccia-based blend. And I was really intrigued by like the texture and the weight. So I started to seek their wines out. And then, as I mentioned during the Via Ambassador studies, Montan Italy was highlighted during the Tuscany module from Sarah Heller. She was doing that presentation as kind of the hero producer, if you will, of Vernaccia. And then, of course, as we're studying, I'm referencing Ian D'Agata's book, and he had a really honorable mention for Montan Italy as well. So it got me more intrigued to search them out.
Right. And so before I mute myself, I want to ask, what are the learning objectives that we should be expecting from this interview?
Yeah, so I think by the end of this, we'll be able to understand kind of the culture and winemaking philosophies of Montanitoli, Alessio, Elisabetta, and to better understand the territory in general. I think we'll have a deeper understanding of the native grapes that they're working with, especially, you know, in the common characteristics of like Vernaccia, Colorino, Sangiovese, Canaiolo Nero. And then towards the end, I would love to ask Elisabetta more questions about her life's work and what makes Montanitoli so special, but not only in the context of wine, but other projects that she's working on.
All right, so I will let you continue with your discussion. So yeah, I'll mute myself now.
Great, thank you, Laika. Hello, Alessio. Hello, Elisabetta. Thank you
for joining. Hello, everybody.
Ciao. I understand you are in New York. Is that true?
Yes. We are in New Yorkers. We are two New Yorkers today.
Well, how fitting. San Gimignano is like the Manhattan of Tuscany, and here you are in actually Manhattan. That's really great. I'm just going to read your bios so I introduce you properly. So Elisabetta has a spirituality about her that is present in her wines. She's the owner of Montanitoli and San Gimignano region of Chianti, Tuscany. Montanitoli means the mountain of the little nest and is comprised of 26 hectares of vineyards surrounded by 200 hectares of woodlands. The property which she owns with her late companion Sergio was brought under vine in 1965 and at the time was an abandoned wilderness. It's located at the top of the hills. The farm is remote and has spectacular vistas of the Chianti hillside. There's a profound respect to the vineyard and the land, which is clearly present in the winemaking of Montanitoli. And Alessio Cecchini is a young Florentine-based winemaker working beside Elisabetta since 2019. He's been traveling all over the world, making wines of New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, Burgundy, and Montalcino before settling at Montanitoli. His studies were focused on concrete fermentations of Sangiovese and biodynamic farming. Today, he supervises the winemaking process and travels the world as an ambassador for Montanitoli. Again, thank you for being here today, and I'm really grateful to follow up with some more questions after my visit there in January. And as I mentioned earlier, there is something very special about your property, Elisabetta, and I would love to learn more. First, where is Sono Montanitoli located? We'll start there. So,
okay. So, where is Montanitoli? Right in the center of Italy. It is the heart of Tuscany. It is the beacon of the Mediterranean Sea. We are just between the East and the West. We are really a light of the two cultures that we want together in our project. We will speak about it later. Anyway, it's just in front of the Chianti Classico and on the slopes of the hill of San Gimignano. That's it, the place.
I love it there. You have the vistas of San Gimignano in the distance, and it is truly a remarkable... Well, first of all, you're not from the area, if that's correct. How did you end up in this region, and how did you choose to start making wine here?
Well, it was not about wine. It was about 9 difficult children that needed to be healed by nature. So we went there, and there was this hill that was totally abandoned, and we found the perfect place for all these little guys to open up and heal the minds, find energy, and go back to the world in a different way. It was very important. And then when they left, I thought that I had to keep this place. It was so beautiful. And so the only way to do on all these rocks is to make wine. Wine is in my blood. I was born into the wine, in the wine culture. You know, my ancestors since the 17th century have been making wine in Custoza near Verona. You know Verona? Of course, in Italy.
Yes, we know it quite well.
Yes. Okay. You want something more?
No, that's perfect. So after your children left, you decided to start making wine. I guess this question wasn't in the script, but I'm curious, did you have any mentors in the region that helped you get started? I mean, did you plant all the vines personally? Were there any vines existing here prior to?
No, there were old vines were really covered by the bushes. They were all abandoned. So the first wine, we went around to pick up the berries, like you just pick up the strawberries in the woods, you know. And we made an incredible red wine. It was 1971. And the first bottles, I sent one to Gino Veronelli, that was the mentor of the wine at that time. And you know where I sold the bottles? I had to touch the enemy in the heart, or anyway, in Paris, of course. So Montanidoli first bottles went to Paris and were sold by our French cousins.
Interesting. And then you continued to grow thereafter?
Then it was a big, very, very big hard work, you know, because at that time there were no women making wine. Physically, I mean, there were many women owners, but I didn't see women in the field. And the first thing, they began to look at my legs, so I decided to put trousers. And that was the beginning. And, you know, my mentors were around the world, but I didn't want them to come into my cellar. I was very jealous of my cellar. The first that went into my cellar is Alessio Cecchini. Before, nobody. Of course, I met them all. I met, of course, Giulio Gambelli. I met Mr. Morsiani, who was a great man in Verona. I met Andrei Cholichev, that honored me of his visit. I met Henri Jaillet, that told me, Elisabetta, you must make the wine this way. And so I went and I heard a lot. And that was, you know, you have to go, taste, to know more. It's always a question of knowledge. It's always a question of getting to know things. This is the way for everything in this world. And if I succeeded to make a wine in Montanidoli, it's because there was a lot of love, a lot of attention, a lot of patience, because you must be modest when you make wine. You must not feel that you are a smart person. You must understand that you know nothing, because nature knows more than you are. And that's why you must go and be attentive and try to make the best you can, very, very slowly. That's it. That is the secret, or my secret anyway. But love is the living matter of everything. That's why maybe you like the feeling and the spirit of Montanidoli, because it's full of love. It's full of, we are a big family, and this is the most important thing, you know?
I do, and I agree. I felt it when we were there. There was just a beautiful energy, you know, not only from the land, but in your home and the people around. And I think that was very, very well said. And Alessio, what an honor. You were the first person to enter Elisabetta's winery. Wow.
Yeah, very lucky for that. So I'm very grateful for what Elisabetta, I mean, she's doing for me. And I mean, not only me, you know, all the family of Montanidoli, because yeah, as you know, we are the, you know, the face at the back of the bottle, but behind the label there is always a group team, you know, that does all the job, and that's very important, you know, that all together we succeed to what we do.
Bravo. Absolutely. Yes. Well, I just want to mention when we were speaking of the land, when we were walking through the vineyards, and Alessio, you were an amazing guide, and thank you for this, that you really can't help notice, but all of the marine fossils and really the thick forest that backs up behind the Montanidoli and olive trees all over. I mean, given this kind of location and terroir, if you will, I mean, what is this? What do these natural elements do to kind of affect the wine, and why? I mean, they must have a great impact, because as you look to the east, you see it wide open, but behind you, it feels like there's you know, much forest. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know, the winemaking is always a mix of, you know, many things, of factors. So first of all, you know, what is really important and what really matters for winemaking is the soil. So when we speak about wine, the first thing Elisabetta showed me at Montanidoli was the three different soils that we have on the hills. So it's basically divided in three layers, where at the bottom we have marine sediments, So it used to be, you know, covered by the water in the Pliocene era, talking about 5 million of years ago. So it was very, very recent, if you want, very young soil. The middle air part of the hill is where we have clay. So it's a soil a bit more, you know, rich, where we grow most of our reds. And the top of the hill, it's completely different soil. It's very old. It's called Triassic soil, 350 million of years ago. So you can imagine how far we go. So it's very rocky, and that's where we have our crew, Sangiovese. Basically surrounded by the bushes. It's a very tough job because, you know, you can imagine how wild it gets with animals, birds, wild boars. So it's very tough to manage, but I think the outcome, yeah, is in the glass. So, yeah, that makes a huge difference. So, you know, the air, the soil, and the light, those are the three most important things in the making. And obviously, you know, the biodiversity. So natural approach, organic approach, respecting anything that goes around a single bunch of wine. That's very important. I think that reflects in the wine very well.
Italian Wine Podcast, brought to you by Mama Jumbo Shrimp.
I have to ask this because, you know, San Gimignano is really defined, as most people know it, as Vernaccia, and first DOC of Italy. But Elisabetta, you didn't really start producing it until 1984. So there was a time period where you were producing, it sounds like, just red wines. But what started, what was the incubus and what was the motive behind working with that particular grape?
For me, coming from the north, you know, and with my mouth, well, with the wine, white wines that I used to drink were the wines that came from Verona, of course, the whites, Alto Adige, and from Burgundy. I had an uncle, a wonderful uncle that was named Paul Baudouin, a great friend of my father, and he was always taking beautiful bottles from Burgundy. And that's why I began to taste white wines in that way. And I found that it was impossible to make a white wine in the red soil and climate of Tuscany. But then when I found out all these marine sediments, then I said, okay, we can make a white also here. But, you know, Vernaccia is the red of the white wines. It has nothing to do with the white wines of the north. And you can't change the nature of what grows in your own place. That's why the Vernaccia of Montenidoli is somehow very different from other Vernaccias. We have our own personality. And you know, the brand is I am a Montenidoli, neither better nor worse, but I am myself. That is what I want to do. That is the spirit. You must get it inside yourself, not outside. You must not go and look at the other bottles and try to be something like them. You have to be yourself all the time, always. Then you will find the truth. That is my way.
I love it. And I have to ask more about Vernaccia because, I mean, you say that it does quite well in marine soils, but you've also been regarded as the kind of the pinnacle and the beacon of producing the Vernaccia of the very traditional style of the past. You know, maybe it has a little bit more oxidative qualities and more serious and more kind of fuller bodied. I think many of the Vernaccia we see on the market are the opposite of that, more bright and, you know, citrus oriented. But how did you understand the style if you were new to winemaking and kind of the snapshot of the past to produce Vernaccia in this traditional way?
Now, look, as I told you, we have to learn all the time. So I went to the old peasants, and they used to do the Vernaccia before the DOCG, before that. I was there in 65, and I used to drink the Vernaccia of these peasants. And they said, if you want to make a good Vernaccia, you have to oxidize it. And if it's not yellow enough, you should add the caramel. And it became a glorious white wine. But anyway, I try to do my best. And Alessio will tell you how it all comes.
So, yeah, actually, you know, it's nice to see the roots of, you know, the beginning of Vernaccia. In one sense, if you want, today we have three different styles of it, you know. The tradizionale, so the name tells everything by itself, you know, it's the old way of making it. Skin contact, obviously, like Elisabetta said, back in the days it was extreme, you know, the wines were, you know, a little bit too harsh, a little bit complicated to drink. So now we do that in a little bit more simple way, so very few days on skins, and everything then goes in concrete, you know, in Tuscany. It's very, very common, and it has been used since, you know, at least 50 years. So it's aged in concrete. We also do two others, Vernaccia. So when we say Vernaccia, it's very important to say that we only do 100% Vernaccia. As you know, it's possible to blend them. Some producers do that with international grape variety, but we don't want to do that. We just keep going with 100%, you know. So the second label will be the Fiore, which is the free run juice, which does only stainless steel aging. Fiore means mosto fiore in Italian. So here comes the name of the label. So free run juice. And the third one is the Carato. So it's the old wine selection as well. The name of the label says where the wine is fermented. So Carato in Tuscan means barrel, barrique. So Carato is barrel fermented and aged for a long time on fine list. And I think there you can see really the potential. And what Elisabetta used to say is the red of the white. So white wines that can age really for decades due to their, you know, natural structure.
Well, thank you for that explanation. I love that anecdote. If it's not yellow, it's not ready. Otherwise, add caramel to it. And I believe if students of wines and serious students of Italian wine, if we need to understand Vernaccia San Gimignano, I think tasting three of these wines side by side by side will give you a really great context to the grape variety. And knowing that it is a slightly tannic variety, that it could use some softening from more oxygen. And I really appreciate that style about what you're producing here. And all three of those are quite unique in their own right. And some of the great whites of Italy, I would proclaim. So really compliment you on that. And to kind of just shift the gear a little bit to talk a little bit about your red wines, Elisabetta, one of my favorite wines, and really all of Tuscany, is the Chianti Colosinese. This, to me, again, is kind of like a snapshot of the past with the blend and the style. I mean, would you be able to kind of describe this wine and a little bit more and what it represents?
Well, the Chianti Colosinese, as it used to be done, the real one, the one that was decided by Bettino Ricasoli in 1870, was the Chianti made with two red and two white grapes. It was an easy drinking wine. At that time, water, you could not drill so a lot of very, very deep. So there was not much water in Tuscany, but there was a lot of wine. So it was easy to drink a lot of wine. So you had an easy drinking wine. This was the old tradition of Bettino Ricasoli, as I said. But then arrived Mr. Parker, that decided that wine, red wine, should be very thick marmalade. And for this reason, the Chianti Classico said, no, no, no white grapes anymore. No, 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 we only want red. And if possible, also other kinds of grapes to be added to Sangiovese. So I was with Gianni Borella, we were two of us, at the Chianti Colosinese, that said, no, we will not follow the Chianti Classico. We want the white grapes to be kept in our Chianti. And for this reason, thanks to God, we go on making Il Garrulo. That's the nice singing name of our Chianti, because it's an easy drinking wine, very old tradition, and very modern kind of wine to be drank easily with tomato, spaghetti, pizza, barbecues, easy drinking, you know. You can drink a whole bottle and then maybe you want a second one. This is the way of a modern wine, not a fake red important. Anyway, Alessio will tell you how we make it.
Yeah, so this is really, to me, the, you know, the picture of Tuscany when you think about field blends. This style of wine reflects it. So it's two reds, it's mostly Sangiovese, and then there is Canaiolo in the blend, and obviously Trebbiano and Malvasia, which are the two whites of the Chianti area, so the central area of Tuscany. So it's a field blend. So means that we pick everything at the same moment, and we mix the grapes directly, you know, in the vats. Fermentation, it's all spontaneous, and, you know, it's concrete again. So it's very, very traditional way of making it. So the wine normally doesn't touch any wood in a way that you have that, you know, freshness and juiciness that concrete only can, you know, rise. And we bottle it quite young, so in a way that you still have, you know, the aromatic side of the four grape varieties together. And yeah, like Elisabetta said, you know, the beauty of the whites inside a red blend is that, you know, you decrease the alcohol, but you increase the acidity. And, you know, sadly, due to the global warming, this is something that, you know, winemakers are looking for, you know, to get the right acidity, the nice pH. So I think it will be a very modern one in the next few years because, yeah, obviously, you know, it's not my topic, but, you know, things are changing. So like anything, we have to adapt. And I would say, you know, like anything, you know, culture stays and trend goes. And this is the best case for this. You know, I think a lot of people, they will go back to the roots of Chianti at some point.
That's interesting. And I find it fascinating, of course, with the climate shifting and getting warmer and warmer vintages. And the introduction of white grapes could be very important, as you just said. And I was just curious. So the historic Chianti recipe, Ricasole, it was Sangiovese, Canaiolo Nero, and Malvasia. Trebbiano, is that... It brings the most acidity, and what would the differences be between the two white grapes? Both acidity, or does Malvasia bring something else to the table?
So, yeah, I would say Trebbiano gives a little bit more acidity, and Malvasia has, you know, it's a semi-aromatic grape variety, so it will give a little bit more of aromas and perfumes to the wine, definitely, yeah. And as you know, Trebbiano can be a grape variety, you know, that grows, sometimes can even overcrop. So it's something that really you can play to adjust, you know, the acidity of a wine if you pick at the right moment. So, yeah, that will be the, you know, the concept of it.
That's great. I highly encourage anyone, if you haven't tried that wine, it's absolutely lovely. And you're right, it's more thirst quenching than anything else. I'm craving a glass right now because it's quite warm here in Denver. And you produce another red wine, which is the 100% Sangiovese, and it is actually called Sono Montanidoli. Well, one, I forgot to ask, what does the name represent, Montanidoli, first of all?
Montanidoli means the mountain of the bird's nest, of the little nests. But you know why? Because the people of San Gimignano used to go up there and steal these little birds from the nest. And it was horrible. But as soon as we arrived, there was no permission to go there and touch the nest. Because, you know, Montanidoli is really an island of... peace and happiness, also for the birds. And the swallows come inside the house to have their nests every year. And now, from March 22nd, we have the swallows in the house, and outside, and inside, everywhere. And they are inhabitants of Montanidoli, as we are. That's the beauty. And about the Sangiovese, we make a pure Sangiovese, young, full of energy. And then we have the old vines that make medicine, as you said. Yes, it is our medicine. Because remember, these poor people that don't drink wine, they have no life in their minds. They have to be healed by a little drop of wine, you know, because it's the real medicine. And if you feel ill, I give you a recipe that is very precious. Grab a good bottle and drink it. That is the way. This is my best. And then I'll tell you, and Alessia will tell you why a good red wine is so important for your health.
Yeah, like Elisabetta was saying, you know, wine has always been in the culture of Italy. And I mean, imagine, I remember the first day at university, they were showing us that in the 60s, Italian used to drink about 240 liters per year of wine. So you can imagine how big it was. Obviously, today we do that a little bit more conscious. But, you know, the reality of things is that Sangiovese is a red grape variety, which is very rich in polyphenols. And polyphenols are the most, you know, natural antioxidant that you can find in nature. So polyphenols are in any plant. They're very rich of that, especially when they turn into red color. So blueberries, blackberries. So anyway, Sangiovese is very rich of it. So has been said by, you know, a lot of scientific data that the good quantity can really help a lot, you know, to fix problems in your body. Yeah, so we want to also, you know, provide the message that wine, you know, it's something that it's part of the, you know, Mediterranean, you know, culture. So, yeah, in this case, I would say Sangiovese is one of those grape varieties where it really you can find one of the biggest amount of polyphenols. So it's, you know, a natural medicine. You know, sometimes you can skip, you know, drugstore and get a nice bottle instead, you know, anything else.
I think most of us who are listening or will be listening would agree that a good bottle of Sangiovese is certainly medicinal. I prescribe to that myself almost at least weekly, if not daily in some regards. And I love that. I would love to ask a question about the, before you moved there, and you mentioned the hunters, Elisabetta, that this property was somewhat abandoned, but it was a hunting ground prior to. And when I was there, I recall you mentioning, Alessio, about the mesadria system and that this area was multiple properties, and then you were able to kind of purchase the hill. Is that correct?
Yes, little by little, I bought all the places around, yes, to build the whole property, yes. But all these groups of houses have been abandoned during the wars. You know, the two wars of the last century have been terrible. And industry, too, because the life of the peasants was incredibly, incredibly poor. There was no water, no electricity, and it was very, very difficult to make a living there. And so everything was mostly abandoned. Also, Montenegro was practically abandoned when we arrived. And that's why, arriving on the 60s, everything was, you could buy everything for little money around there. And now everything has changed, of course.
That's interesting. Thank you for sharing that. And yes, I mean, what is the culture like today in the area? I mean, if you go to San Gimignano, you see thousands of tourists every day. Have they discovered the wines of Sono Montanitoli? And
I think that it is very bad for the wine. Because, you know, wine, on my opinion, is a question of culture, of time, of patience. And all these tourists, you know, they offer the chance to give, to sell a young wine and get the money at once. And so it's not a question of love and attention to do something, to get to the soul of what you're doing. It's only a question of marketing. And this is a bad point. The tourists are not, in my opinion, good for a good wine.
I've read this in a couple occasions. In certain regions of Italy where there's a major metropolis, that it's almost as if you can pump out wine quickly and there will be a captive audience of consumers automatically. And I think your point is well taken that perhaps the wine quality suffers a little bit. So again, that's a compliment to you with maintaining this traditional style and putting an emphasis on quality and aging before, you know, releasing to the market. So compliments. You know, I love the rosé wine that you produce. And it's, I think rosé in the world has become somewhat trendy and almost predictable in a lot of ways with flavors and profiles. But yours, on the other hand, I would say is quite serious and is produced with another native grape, the Canaiolo. You know, could you maybe unpack that, describe this wine a little bit more and the unique qualities that it, and winemaking?
Well, at the beginning, we were fermenting every single grape in a different little vat. And while we were mixing up the must of Canaiolo, Sergio said, "Oh, how funny. This wine, this must has the nice nose of a white and the body of the red." Oh, and then we said, "Oh, we can make a rosé out of it." You know? And that's why we began to make a rosé. That was the first idea of a rosé. And, of course, what is a rosé? A rosé is something that wants to steal the place of a white and wants to steal the place of a red. So we always called it a transgender, because it's neither a white nor a red, just a rosé. But, of course, we tried to make a good rosé. And it became very popular. In 78, it has been the best rosé in Germany of a choice out of 280 rosé, because it is very, very mineral. We had it with a very high acidity. And it is like, we called it our Schweppes. We had it was something for the boat to take away thirst, something that has to stay outside your meals. It must be a welcome drink, something that you can have any time for any occasion, but not a proper meal. A proper meal needs a white or a red and a white, as you want.
A transgender rosé. And can this wine, I mean, I've read that this wine ages quite well, so I'm curious about that, first of all, and then it's very rare that you see a single varietal Canaiolo Nero. I'm curious about Canaiolo Nero in general, in the vineyard, in the winery itself, and, you know, really what it also brings to the table as a grape variety.
Canaiolo is actually, you know, very similar to Sangiovese. So if you look at the DNA stream, if I'm not wrong, they share more than 60% of DNA. So it's basically the same family. But what you can really see, the main difference in terms of vineyard is that, you know, the bunch of Canaiolo, so the grapes of Canaiolo, they have a slightly soft skin compared to the Sangiovese. And normally, you know, the farmers, you know, as they were, they are very smart. They noticed that adding Canaiolo in the Sangiovese was increasing, you know, the bouquet. So it means that it's a very, you know, floral, very gentle grape variety. And I think that's where, you know, Sergio discovered it, you know, by tasting, by, you know, putting his hand on the wine, saying, "Wow, this wine tastes, you know, different, very similar to a white. You know, it's very delicate." And that's how it started. You know, it's actually a vineyard that grows in the soils of the white, so marine sediments. So there is a lot of limestone. A lot of limestone means low pH and high acidity. So the wines are almost salty. If you taste them, you know, blind tasting, you would say this is a wine that comes from a coastal area, from an island. We are not in the coast. We are 60 kilometers inland, but the soil is the soil, is the soil of the, you know, of the sea, the fossils, you know, and that reflects a lot in the wine. I think the style, yeah, of the Canaiolo in this case, it's very unique for Tuscany. You know, is a rosé meant to be rosé from the vineyard? It's not heavy. You know, sometimes the rosé in Tuscany can be dark. They can be Salasso. In this case, this is, you know, made to be a rosé. And what we do is that we need just to be sure to pick the grapes in the right moment. When we have the acidity right. And we just keep the skins of the Canaiolo just for a few hours in contact, in a way that we don't, you know, get too much color, too much tannins. So it's very soft, you know, this is what is very important about this wine. Then you know, fermentation is in stainless steel, so you have the, you know, you keep the aromas of the grape variety very alive. And obviously, you know, a little bit of finely aging, you give a little structure to the wine. And this is maybe something that we should not say, Elisabetta, she always keeps this secret, but this we can share it, I would say, is that we bottle the wine the first quarter of the moon. You know, we follow moon phases as, you know, moon is, it's very attractive for liquids, for many things, you know, in nature. And normally the first quarter of the moon is when you should drink your bubbles. So if you go in Champagne, Franciacorta, Trento, they will probably be bottling, you know, their wines in that timing, that phase of the moon. So that gives little fizziness in the tongue, you know, you can really pick it. And that makes everything a bit more, you know, fresh, crispy. And that's what, you know, Canaiolo is made for. Elisabetta like to say is the champagne of poor people, you know. Obviously, we are in Tuscany, we are not in Champagne. But, you know, we have to provide something, you know, very dry, very crispy, but still elegant, you know. That's the concept of the Canaiolo, I would say.
I would certainly align with the poor people. I would drink this rosé every day if I could. And of course, we all love champagne, but there is something to be said about this style of rosato. So it's beautiful. And, you know, this is a good time to chat about, Elisabetta, your foundation. You mentioned Sergio and the work that you were building together as partners. Can you tell us more about your foundation? Well, first the name and the project that you're working on at Montenidoli, please.
Now, I can tell you that Montenidoli has been the nest of 9 children that were they needed to be healed. And Montenidoli, since, has always received many people that needed to find the light in their own lives. Because Sergio has been a very big teacher. He was a great psychologist. You know, many people arrived there, they were so upset. He used to spend a long night with them, chatting all the night, and the following morning, they left and they were happy. That is very important. And the spirit, they called him the patriarch. And that's why the foundation, when he passed away, became Sergio the Patriarch Foundation. But since the beginning, we always thought that the most important thing in our lives is knowledge. We are teachers. We come from the family of teachers. So knowledge is the most important thing. And we must learn how to listen. We must learn how to understand. And this is the way you can find more the capacity of sharing and of loving each other. Because, you know, the modern society is closed up in a web. We are all fixed with our iPad, with our iPhone, with our computer, and we are more and more alone in a world that is becoming more and more violent. And we need to know better about each other. And we need to chase fear. That fear is coming around. Everybody has more and more fear of what is happening because they have no knowledge. They don't know how to gather the riches of all the people that invented great religions, great cultures around the world. They are so different, but so similar, because we all belong to humans. And we are the big family of a small planet. That's what I'm always saying. And we must share, and we must learn. And that's why we gave 2 groups of houses up the hill. They have to host olders and youngsters, because they have to give the past towards a more rich future. The young people must go steady and more rich and more knowing of what is had. What is our heritage. We must keep our heritage. We must not forget about it. You see, this is important. And the guest house must become also a place for seminars, for learned people that have to speak. And we have to make, you know, a big center of knowledge. This is the real world. Because through knowledge, you can succeed to get peace. And you, through knowledge, you get culture. And culture is peace. And this is our, really, what we want to build and to do. And this has to become, we must put this online for make a big library that will gather all the voices, positive voices. We have enough to bad news every morning. No, we can have a choice to look at the light, to look what is positive. And through positive, you become positive. And through positiveness and sharing, you know how to make, to have love with people and to be in love and be in peace and have a beautiful life. We only have one life. Why shall we spoil it with bad things? It's our choice. We must do that. We must heal all these politicians with a good glass of wine, of course. That is our foundation.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I know it's really important work, and I believe, I agree that we're somewhat losing this generational knowledge passed down from one older group, let's say, to the next. So just to kind of unpack that more, and I would love to hear more about the two groups. You have a group that is elderly, let's say, and one in youth, and they are in two separate homes, and then they coexist, they live together for how long, and do they work in the vineyards, or is this mostly, you know, workshops and discussions? I would love to hear more about this.
No. We need no work in the vineyards. They need to learn. They need to hear. They need to share. And I would like 1 month to host them for 1 month. Too long would spoil, because they would get, they would become sleepy, because they have to give an energy, get the energy. And then we need some seminars, people that come there and they teach and they give news about geology, about winemaking, about psychology, about everything. We need to make a kind of a university of knowledge. But you know, what happens is that our wines are not expensive enough. We live in a region where the wines are they have a very reasonable price and not enough to keep this going. That's why we need donators, supporters. That's why with the old bottles and the old wines and the magnums that we grow on the Triassic soil must provide donators and supporters. We need that badly. We must make a big family of supporters for our foundation. Otherwise, it won't work. We must make our dreams come through. And that is the way. And that's why we are building dinners for the foundation around the world. We have one now in Washington, D.C. We had one yesterday evening in New Jersey. And we're going this way. This is the way.
To learn more about this, you can go to sergiothepatriarch.org. And there is a donate button as well. And I would love to connect with you outside of this conversation about perhaps hosting one of these dinners in the Rocky Mountain region and in Denver specifically. It would be an honor to support this work. So we'll talk more about that.
I wanted to come to Aspen for the wine fair, Food and Wine Classic.
Well, I imagine we can arrange that. That's in June annually. So Denver is just on the way up there, unless you're flying in on your private jet and then you fly over us.
So. If I had the private jet, then it would be, the foundation would grow wonderfully, tremendously. But we can arrange a dinner in Denver too. Why not? Wonderful. One in Denver and one in Aspen.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Excellent. Thank you. Another thought that I was having, and during a visit there, you served some amazing dishes and small bites, aperitivo-like bites, and gosh, the olive oil, I have to say, I'm kind of changing gears a little bit, but you know, when I think of Tuscany, it's not singular in just wine, but I feel like the olive oil there in Montenidli was quite special. Which cultivars are you working with? And I'm curious more about the olive program there, because it's the topping on all the little bites was absolutely amazing.
But now what is amazing is our Napolitan cook that comes from Pompeii, from Antonella. She is fantastic. She is the one that makes a miracle out of our very good olive oil that comes out of Moraiolo and Correggiolo, fundamentally. These two kinds of olives, olive trees. And remember that San Gimignano is one of the most or the best places to produce olive oil in the whole of Tuscany. This is it. Tavernelle and San Gimignano, the two best places. Remember, if you want good olive oil, you get it in San Gimignano and Tavernelle. But of course, on the hill, a lot of air, a lot of light. That makes it always the big secret, as Alessia said, is light and the air and soil.
Well, I'm grateful for Antonella and her work. Everything was absolutely amazing. And I can't wait to visit again to purchase liters and liters of olive oil. One of the final questions I have, I guess, is can students of wine or the public make visits to your property, and how would they do so? How would
they get in touch? They just come along. No, they have to send an email, and it's home for them. It will be home always. We are open, and it will be wonderful. Well, already they come. There are groups of students that arrive to Montenidoli, and they are very welcome.
Thank you for that. And I would attest that you opened your doors wide. I mean, our tasting was literally in your home, not during the time of nesting, but it felt really personal, and I'm very grateful for your hospitality.
You saw the nest waiting for the swallows, didn't you?
I did. So we'll be back in June, and we will actually see the birds hanging out there, I would say, if they're still nesting there at that time.
Oh, yes, it is right the time they're nesting. That's why we respect them very much, you know. It's their home then, and it's rather private when the little ones are there.
One final question, and I know that this area, of course, is known for the Bistecca Fiorentina, Canina beef. What would you maybe pair with, so let's say, Vernaccia San Gimignano, let's call it the Fiore, the one that's bright and fresh?
No, not with the Fiorentina. With the Fiorentina, you need a good Sangiovese. The Sangiovese of Montenidoli are perfect for the Fiorentina. Both of them, the Montenidoli Rosso and the Solo Montenidoli. But for a fiore, you can have it by the glass to begin your food. And then it's very nice with any kind of delicate food. French cuisine is perfect. I always say that the tradizionale is for olive oil cuisine, Mediterranean cuisine. Fiore is more for international French cuisine because it's more delicate. But some fried, we had yesterday night, in New Jersey, we had an incredible fried vegetables with a perfect Vernaccia Tradizionale. It was perfect. Because pairings are really the big art of our lives. If we don't learn how to pair things, we spoil a lot of the best part of our lives. It's to live properly. It's a kind of art, you know. It's a kind of attention, of love, as usual. Without love, there is no color in our lives. We need the joy of life comes out of love, out of freedom, feeling free, feeling the joy of whatever surrounds us. And you know, what I lived in Japan, and the secret of Japanese people say, perfection is everywhere. You must only have the art of finding it. This is important. So let's live trying to find the beauty and the perfection everywhere. And we shall be happy and live properly and enjoy a good wine, a good glass of wine. That's the way.
Elisabetta, you're an inspiration. Thank you to you and Alessio both for sharing this time and this space. And you offered some really great advice. One, to look at your surroundings and feel the love, as well as drinking drink a good glass of wine every day. Why not? I love it. So thank you both.
No. May I tell you something more? You know, on the back of the bottle that you drank and discovered in San Gimignano, Il Templare, on the back label, not in the American ones, I'm sorry, but in the Italian ones, it's written, the rule of Saint Bernard. The rule of Saint Bernard that was taken by the Templar Knights says you are allowed to drink as much wine as you need in order to chase chillness of your mind, of your heart, of your body. You are not allowed to get drunk, but if you need 1, 2, 3 bottles, they're welcome. Remember, it's a wonderful, wonderful recipe.
The World Health Organization is pushing the opposite agenda now, it seems, with consumption of wine. So again,
that is why everybody's ill. This is the problem.
Thank you so much for sharing. Leica, it looks like you've popped on. Are there any questions?
Yeah, so we have 2 minutes left. So I'm opening the floor to the audience. If you guys have any questions, you can raise your hand so that you can ask Elisabetta and Alessio if you have any. So I also wanted to mention that there are 2 comments from the audience. So Kevin has said that he loved your olive oil. And also Noelle, she was here earlier, but then she also said that the discussion was very amazing. Thank you so much. It was so engaging and inspiring. So yes, that's it. Do you have any last more questions, Scott, before I close the room?
No, I'll just again offer my gratitude for taking the time. I know you're busy in New York, you know, promoting the wines of Montanitoli and your culture and spreading it around the world. So I'm very grateful for this opportunity, and I'm looking forward to visiting again in June and many, many times thereafter. So we'll keep in touch about the foundation. And again, if anyone is curious, please visit that website to learn more about what the work that they're doing there. So thank you so much. Grazie mille.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Such a big pleasure.
And such an honor to be with you. Thank you.
The honor is ours. Thank you so much.
Listen to the Italian Wine Podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We're on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Himalaya FM, and more. Don't forget to subscribe and rate the show. If you enjoy listening, please consider donating through italianwinepodcast.com. Any amount helps cover equipment, production, and publication costs. Until next time, cin cin.